Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
I didn't know a single person diagnosed with autism when I was a kid. I know lots today. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. As of last year, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control estimated one out of every 68 babies born will have an autism spectrum disorder, which is astonishing for a condition that was hardly known to physicians until a few decades ago. Autism turns out to have had a sort of twin birth in terms of its identification by scientists working in Europe and the United States. The definition put forth here held sway for a very long time, and it turns out played into some damaging misconceptions about what autism is and what causes brains with autism to work differently than neurotypical ones. Journalist Steve Silberman has written for Wired, The New Yorker, the MIT Technology Review, and the journal Nature. He uncovers the fascinating history of the study, diagnosis, and treatment of autism in his new book, Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's really an honor to be here.
You got interested in autism when you experienced what appeared at the time in the year 2000 to be sort of a bizarre coincidence when you wanted to interview some entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. I was actually on a cruise ship in Alaska, and I was with 100 computer programmers as part of the maiden voyage of something called the Geek Cruise, which was an entrepreneur's efforts to basically hold tech conferences in more interesting places than hotels. And so there we were, you know, cruising up towards the Arctic Circle. It was beautiful. And one of the stars of the cruise was a guy who invented one of the first open source programming languages that ended up becoming very widely used. And in fact, that language was used to build stuff like Amazon and Craigslist and the Internet Movie Database. It's hard to imagine the Internet without it. And towards the end of the cruise, I asked him if I could come to his house in Silicon Valley to interview him. And he said, yeah, sure, I should tell you, we have an autistic daughter. And like most people, I didn't know that much about autism beyond Rain Man at that point. It was still considered a very rare neurological condition. If I ever thought about it, I thought I would probably never meet an autistic person because it was so rare. As you said just a minute ago, you know, you had never met autistic people when you were young, neither had I. So it didn't make much of an impression. But when I interviewed the guy, I noticed that he had customized his living environment so that it was a little softer on his very sensitive senses. For example, he had replaced the buzzer on his clothes dryer with a little light bulb that would light up when the cycle was done, so there wouldn't be this loud, unexpected, sudden buzz. And so I noticed that, and that was interesting, but his daughter wasn't there anyway, and so, you know, I just kind of went on with my life. And then a few months later, I was writing about another technologically very adept family in Silicon Valley. And in fact, the patriarch of that family built the first computer in the Middle East long ago. So I asked the sister-in-law of a woman I was profiling if I could come interview her at home. And she said, yeah, sure. By the way, we have an autistic daughter. And I thought, God, isn't that a funny coincidence? Two families in Silicon Valley whose children have this rare neurological condition. So I was telling that exact story to a friend of mine in my neighborhood cafe in San Francisco, and a woman at the next table suddenly interrupted and blurted out, oh my God, do you realize what's happening? And I said, what's happening? And she said, I'm a special education teacher in Silicon Valley. There's an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley. Something terrible is happening to our children. And so, being a science writer, when I heard that, I got the chills just as a human being, but B, as a science writer, I got the urge to find out if what she was saying was true and to do some reporting. And so I ended up writing an article called The Geek Syndrome about autism in Silicon Valley in 2001, and it was very well received, but as time went on, I kept getting email about it for years on end, and most of it was, you know, it was very good email. It was from autistic people themselves who recognized themselves in the article, the families of autistic people, people who suddenly realized that relatives that they'd had were probably autistic. But what most of the letters were about was the lack of services for families of autistic people. And so they were saying that the kids who had been diagnosed in the 90s, when the diagnoses started to rise, were now, quote unquote, aging out of services. And that once those kids graduated high school, the families were basically left on their own with very little help and support. And so I started to be haunted by the notion that I had missed the story, in a sense, by focusing so narrowly on the dynamics of autism in high-tech communities like Silicon Valley. I had missed the larger story of why the diagnoses were going up all over the world, not just in places like Silicon Valley, and the issues that families were struggling with.
So you, of course, can be forgiven for that narrow focus. There's a parallel to it in the story that you tell in this book. So I want to step back here, talk about how autism was first identified. And we should say identified because, first of all, it seems pretty clear that autism and autism spectrum, what we now call autism spectrum disorders, have been part of the human experience for a very long time.
That's true. In fact, the first autistic character that one meets in my book after the introduction was a guy who lived at the end of the 18th century, who was one of the most brilliant scientists on Earth. But in fact, the word scientist hadn't even been invented yet. He was helping to invent several fields of science. But he was also considered extremely odd by his peers. In fact, one of them said he was, quote, painfully shy, bordering on disease. And so there was no explanation for his the consistency of his behavior. He ate basically the same thing at every meal, leg of mutton. He took a walk at precisely the same time every single day for decades. He wore exactly the same clothes for decades. When they would wear out, he would have his tailor create an identical suit of clothes. So in many ways, he was what we now would instantly recognize as autistic. But because there were no words or framework for it, people didn't know what to make of him.
Are there any dangers, caveats in sort of going back through the history books and pointing to people that look very much to us today, like those who would fall on the autism spectrum?
Oh, that is a very excellent point. And in fact, I'm extremely conservative about doing what's called retrodiagnosis, because I think most of it is bunk. You know, people say, oh, Einstein was autistic. Well, you know, he was perhaps shy, but I wouldn't necessarily jump to the conclusion that he was autistic. People tell me that Steve Jobs was autistic. Well, I met Steve Jobs, and I don't think he was autistic. He may have had autistic traits, but autistic traits are very common, as Hans Asperger knew and noticed. So, you know, there's sort of it's kind of a hipster parlor game to diagnose people. And in fact, Jerry Seinfeld last year sort of infamously diagnosed himself after going to see Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime on Broadway. He said, I think I'm on the spectrum. Well, I don't know how much support and accommodations Jerry Seinfeld needs to lead a satisfying life, although I will admit I don't know what his inner state is. But anyway, he seems to be doing very well. So the problem with extending the spectrum into infinity and saying, oh, you know, yes, we're all on the spectrum, aren't we, is that then the people who really need help and the families that really need help don't get it. And you know, it's easy to spread the spectrum out until it means really nothing, you know. So in the case of Henry Cavendish, though, the scientist that I described, I did not retrodiagnose him. The person who retrodiagnosed him is the very recently late Oliver Sacks, the neurologist and author. And he wrote a paper for the journal Neurology in which he explained that Henry Cavendish was a classic case of Asperger syndrome. Oliver was a wonderful man. He ended up becoming a friend of mine. I miss him very much already, actually.
He wrote the foreword to your book.
He did. It was one of the last things that he wrote. I consider myself very lucky and very grateful to him for doing that. And, you know, in a way, it was very appropriate because he was ahead of the curve so many times in so many different ways that I really felt like my book after a while was kind of a tribute to a path that he had blazed in autism.
I had the honor of interviewing him a couple of times, and he was always delightful. And I know that you two got to be friends in the course of you. It started as a relationship where you interviewed him and you became friends.
That's true. One of my favorite anecdotes about hanging out with Oliver was that we were in a health food store, more or less, and I saw a bunch of sage leaves, and they were very, very furry. And so I asked Oliver, who I knew had, one of his many, many, many personal interests was botany. And so I said to Oliver, I wonder why sage has such furry leaves. And he looked at me and smiled and said, because they like it. He was a fabulous person. I will never meet his kind again, I'll say. I'm really going to miss him.
I'm sorry for your loss and for the loss of so many people who knew and cared about him.
Yeah.
You mentioned a name a few minutes ago, Hans Asperger, familiar to many people, although they may know the name and not necessarily know anything about him. He was a scientist working in Vienna.
That's true. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that hardly anyone, unless they've read my book, know anything about him, really. I mean, they know the phrase Asperger syndrome. They may even have been saying the label in reference to themselves for a decade now. But the truth is, Hans Asperger has been a kind of missing person in the autism literature. Not altogether missing. A brilliant cognitive psychologist named Uta Frith wrote a book in the 90s, I believe, early 90s, called Autism and Asperger Syndrome, that contains about three paragraphs about his clinic. But it struck me that there was so little known about Asperger and his clinic when I started to research my book. So I made it my business to really research what was going on there. And one of the most striking things about it was that I quickly realized that Asperger and his colleagues were very prescient in that they really discovered what we now call the autism spectrum back in the 1930s, I would say. But the other thing that is true is that if you pull the camera back from the wonderful things that were happening in his clinic, what's going on in the background is the beginnings of the Holocaust. Mm. And so I wondered, why did no one write about Asperger in the context of the society that he was living in and the horrible historical events that were unfolding in the background? And what I found, as we can get into, is that those events had a profound effect on the future of autism.
He was living in a time and place where something identified to be a, air quotes here, mental deficiency was tantamount to a death sentence.
Absolutely. The Nazis were attempting to, eventually, they were attempting to purge hereditary forms of disability. I mean, they didn't have a word for autism yet, but the Nazis launched a secret extermination campaign against disabled children that was basically a practice run for the Holocaust. The Nazis figured out how to do murder on a mass scale, how to transport bodies, etc., by practicing on disabled, both children and adults. And so what happened was the children in Asperger's clinic became a target. And in fact, one of Asperger's former colleagues, a guy named Erwin Jekelius, and this is one of the many things I discover in the book, became the head of that secret extermination program.
All right, let's take a pause here on that distressing note, and we'll take a quick break. My guest is journalist Steve Silberman. He has written for Wired, The New Yorker, MIT Technology Review, and the journal Nature. His new book is called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with science journalist Steve Silberman. His new book is called Neurotribes, the Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. You can join the conversation at 800-933-5372 or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Okay, so Steve, let's talk about how Asperger identified what would ultimately be called the autism spectrum. What was he seeing in his patients?
Well, what's fascinating is that one of the things that I discovered for the book is that Asperger's clinic in Vienna, it was located at the University Hospital in Vienna, was founded by a guy named Erwin Lazar, who had this kind of funny idea that humanity was organized into teams or tribes, and that's where the title of my book comes from, and that these teams or tribes were distinguished by a particular set of challenges that the individuals in that group would have to face and a particular set of gifts or aptitudes that the individuals would have. And he saw his job as a child psychologist to identify which tribe, in a sense, each child in his clinic belonged to. And so Asperger took that even farther, and he ended up discerning what he called the autism continuum in the children in his clinic. So it was a very, very broad range of clinical presentations, ranging all the way from children who could not speak or live independently and would probably have to live for the rest of their lives in institutions or at least with constant care, and to very chatty kids that he called his little professors, who were fascinated by things like chemistry and astronomy. And in fact, one of his former patients, who was, by the way, very profoundly disabled when he was young, grew up to become a professor of astronomy who was still blatantly autistic, as Asperger called him, but was able to have a career and to do really well. He actually disproved one of Isaac Newton's proofs while he was in graduate school. So, you know, between those two extremes, Asperger saw a continuum, or what we now call a spectrum.
So Asperger was influenced by this idea that you could put people into these different categories or tribes. Across the Atlantic, another scientist named Leo Kanner was working at Johns Hopkins, and he was really influenced by the writing of Freud.
Yes, he was. Let me tell the whole story in a sense. What happened was in 1943, this guy named Leo Kanner, it looks like Kanner, but it's actually Kanner. He used to work in a state hospital, and the patients would call him Father O'Connor, despite the fact that he was Jewish. But anyway, so Leo Kanner, who himself was from Eastern Europe as well, he was working as one of the first child psychiatrists in America in Baltimore. And in 1938, this child named Donald Triplett was sent to his clinic from down south. And when Kanner first saw him, he did not know what to make of his behavior. He had seen a lot of children who he described as pre-psychotic, children who had some of these same traits. But Donald's behavior was really, really striking. And so what Kanner did was he sent him to a colleague named George Frankel, who was the head psychologist at an affiliate of Hopkins called the Child Study Home. And so this guy, George Frankel, evaluated Donald. And lo and behold, George Frankel knew exactly what was going on with Donald. Why? Because George, and this is something that no one has ever, I figured this out. It's the solution to a great historical mystery. George Frankel was Hans Asperger's chief diagnostician in Vienna. And in fact, George Frankel had been rescued by Leo Kanner from the Holocaust as part of a truly heroic thing that Kanner and his wife did, which was to rescue Jewish clinicians, basically, from the Holocaust. So Frankel came over. He was also joined by his wife, Annie Weiss Frankel, who was also one of Asperger's former colleagues. And in fact, I found a completely overlooked case history of an autistic boy from Asperger's Clinic, written in the 1930s, that is certainly the first case history of autism from Asperger's Clinic, and really, in a way, the first case history of autism, or one of them anyway, ever written. So Frankl and Annie Weiss-Frankl knew exactly what autism looked like. And in fact, Frankl evaluated Connor's first three autistic patients. And so Connor, even though he would end up taking credit for the discovery of autism, even though the virtually simultaneous discoveries of autism in Vienna and Baltimore would be described by historians for decades now as one of the biggest sort of medical mysteries of the 20th century. Like, why did they both figure it out at the same time? Oh, it's some grand synchronicity. It turns out there was this guy, George Frankl, that was working for both Connor and Asperger. And it was certainly Frankl who transmitted the expertise of Asperger's Clinic directly to Connor's office. The problem is that Connor ended up not seeing autism as a spectrum. He had a different agenda. Asperger's Clinic was not just a clinic, it was also a school. Asperger and his colleagues were very invested in the success of the children in his clinic. Connor's clinic was more like a clinic where kids would, you know, be brought in to be evaluated for various forms of mental illness. So what Connor saw in Donald and in the succeeding patients was the opportunity to define a new disorder that was the first form of psychosis believed to be endemic to childhood. So because Connor was one of the first child psychiatrists in America, that would be a huge win, in a sense, for child psychiatry, because they would define this previously unknown form of psychosis. The problem is that Connor eventually gave in to sort of peer pressure from his Freudian colleagues and blamed that form of psychosis on parents. And he referred to refrigerator parenting. And the archetype of the quote-unquote refrigerator mother proved to be indelible in the American imagination. And many, many bad things came from that, like the fact that the recommended course of treatment for autism for decades was institutionalization, to remove the child from the allegedly toxic psychological environment created by the family. And so the families not only were dealing with the challenges of raising an autistic child, they were dealing with a burden of guilt and shame that had been laid on them by these psychiatrists who did not know what they were talking about. Asperger believed that autism was primarily genetic. In fact, he very presciently believed that it was caused by the interaction of multiple genes. Now we know exactly that that's true, but it took until the 1970s for anyone to even say that autism was genetic. So Asperger really was very prescient. And Connor was, you know, in some ways he was very prescient. His descriptions of his first 11 patients are beautiful. They established autism as a clinical entity in the United States. But because he had such a narrow view of it and he sort of fought off the idea of the spectrum, he also buried Asperger's work in history. He never once mentioned Asperger or his work in his own work, even though he was the world's leading authority on autism for decades. Thus, Asperger's paper, which came out a year after Connor's in German, was virtually unread until the 1980s in America. And because Asperger had discovered the spectrum, in a sense, Connor also buried the spectrum. And it wasn't until the 1970s that Connor mentioned Asperger very dismissively for the only time in his published career. He in an obscure book review, Connor said, "Oh, yes, Asperger. What that person discovered was, at best, a 42nd cousin of my syndrome and has already received serious attention from investigators." So, which wasn't true at all. Hardly anyone had heard of it, even in the field. So, you know, Connor rendered Asperger invisible and thus rendered the autism spectrum invisible and ended up creating a situation where children, you know, two generations of children were put into institutions.
To be clear, if Leo Kanner helped to rescue the likes of people like scientists like Ani Weiss and George Frenkel from Asperger's lab, what was Asperger's relationship to the Nazi Party?
Well, I do want to be clear. Kanner didn't rescue Ani Weiss. She came over on her own a bit earlier, but he did rescue George Frenkel and many others. I suspect that Kanner's relationship with the Nazi Party was extremely complicated. His boss, Franz Hamburger, was one of the most prominent Nazis in Austria. Franz Hamburger loved Hitler. And as I mentioned before, Asperger's former colleague, Erwin Jekelius, became the head of the child extermination program in Vienna. So the Gestapo actually came to Asperger's clinic three times to arrest him for violating the eugenics laws by, in a sense, hiding or harboring these children who were carrying hereditary conditions. Asperger, as I say in the book, almost certainly had to take a loyalty oath to Hitler to retain his job. However, I determined that Asperger was the member of a Christian youth group that was very anti-Nazi and had been banned, in fact, by the Nazis, called the Wandering Scholars. And Asperger thought that the Wandering Scholars were one of the best things that he'd ever been a part of. In fact, that the Wandering Scholars sort of rescued him from being a tedious pedant that he had been when he was young. He was sort of obsessed with this kind of goth poet named Franz Gilparzer. And the Wandering Scholars got him out into the mountains, and he met his wife on one of their trips. And so he loved the Wandering Scholars, and they were very anti-Nazi. So I believe that Asperger himself was anti-Nazi, but I'm sure there were some very complicated negotiations that he had to make, because after all, Asperger was doing his work really as the Holocaust got ramped up. So he, I envision him walking to the University of Vienna, which, by the way, became the intellectual center of the eugenics movement in Austria. So he was surrounded by bumbling Nazi fanatics. The Jewish faculty had been purged. Many of them killed themselves, actually, or were dragged off to concentration camps. Asperger must have had some complex calculus in his mind. Well, I'll keep doing this work, even though I'm surrounded by Nazis, because I'm protecting the children here and I'm doing good work. But, it was a very complicated and dire situation for Asperger. He said in a radio interview towards the end of his life that it was a very dangerous situation for him.
So Leo Kanner's definition of what autism was pretty limited, and therefore made the condition relatively rare in the general population. Asperger's was more expansive. How did their ideas, if Kanner said these individuals, these children need to be institutionalized, what were Asperger's ideas about the best ways to educate and care for people on the autism spectrum?
Well, here's the fascinating thing. For one thing, many of Asperger's writings are still untranslated. Like, one of the things that I really hope to trigger by writing this book was a fascination with Asperger, so people can, investigate further to his Nazi connection, but also to explore his ideas. Because one of the most interesting things that he said was that he developed methods of teaching autistic children by listening to autistic children. And he had one boy that he called Harrow in his writing, who was one of his quote-unquote little professors. And Asperger, he said, much can be learned from him. Harrow was considered a very, very difficult child. He had been expelled from school. He was, he would crawl around on the floor of the classroom and, say that, he wouldn't do his homework, et cetera. So he was considered a very, very difficult child. And in fact, many of the children in Asperger's clinic came there because they were expelled from school, or they came through the court system because they'd been arrested for some infraction. They were rebellious kids for the most part. And yet Asperger listened to them and listened to what they needed. And one of the things that Asperger learned from Harrow and other children was that autistic children tend to pursue facts and knowledge for their own sake, not to impress the teacher. They pursue their interests because they're interested in them. And, you know, they get a thrill out of pursuing their special interests, as many parents of autistic kids can attest, you know, whether it's Pokemon or chemistry or something on the internet or Disney movies or whatever. Autistic kids have a tremendous drive to find out more facts about stuff that they are interested in. And in fact, you know, one of the reasons why autistic kids were considered trouble or are considered trouble is that they ask a lot of questions, you know. And for Asperger, that indicated that they were just trying to learn about the world in their own eccentric way. For Connor, you know, the constant questioning was interpreted as another sign of pathology, allegedly to get the approval of the parents, you know, who'd be interested in this stuff, allegedly. I mean, that was wrong. That was, you know, one of Connor's wrong ideas. I don't want to totally put Connor down. And I do want to mention that, you know, I've thought long and hard. I became, obviously, if you read the book, rather fascinated with both Asperger and Connor. And I've thought long and hard, like, why would Connor, who in many ways was a very compassionate and certainly very brilliant clinician, why would he bury Asperger's work in history and also, you know, in a sense, obscure the Frankl connection? Because Connor used to say that it was serendipity that he had discovered autism in 1938. And the main thing I can come up with is that because Connor was Jewish and because he, you know, had put this heroic effort into rescuing clinicians, maybe he thought that Asperger had collaborated with the Nazis. And so maybe he was not interested in giving credit to his Viennese counterpart. I would understand that. It just had a terrible effect.
My guest is journalist Steve Silberman. He's written for Wired, The New Yorker, the MIT Technology Review, and the journal Nature, among other publications. His new book is called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter. I'm at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with science writer Steve Silberman. His new book is called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, we obviously are skipping over a lot of great content in your book, but we've got the history so far. People may be fascinated, but then wonder what this has to do with the apparent rise in autism that we have seen over the past couple of decades. And in fact, it does all end up sort of in the same place.
It does. So what happened was, as we talked about earlier, whereas Asperger's model of autism was very, very broad and inclusive, Leo Connor's model of autism was very, very narrow and restrictive. However, Leo Connor's model was not challenged for decades. He became the world's leading authority on autism. He called his office the National Clearinghouse for Autism Diagnoses. And his notion that autism was very rare became, in a sense, a self-fulfilling prophecy, because he once bragged that he turned away 9 out of 10 children referred to his office by other clinicians for a diagnosis of autism away without giving them an autism diagnosis. So to get an autism diagnosis in the 1950s and 60s and really into the 70s was very, very difficult. And in fact, just the other day, I was talking with an 88-year-old autism clinician who started working in the 40s named Steen Levy. And she said that by the time she saw a child who she would diagnose with autism in the 70s, they had usually seen 10 specialists already.
Wow.
Imagine how few families could afford to see 10 specialists before finally getting a diagnosis of autism. So autism was extremely rare, and that was primarily because of the way that Connor drew the diagnosis very narrowly. You know, he felt he was defending it against it being diluted by other people, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, so finally, what happened to change things was that in the 1970s, there was a woman in England who was a cognitive psychologist named Lorna Wing. And Lorna knew from autism because she had a daughter named Susie who was profoundly autistic. And in fact, Susie certainly would have met the criteria for diagnosis by Leo Connor. She was more or less a classic case. But Lorna was also one of the founders of the Autism Parents Movement, certainly in England, and it was really the first Autism Parents Movement. And so Lorna was in touch with lots and lots of families, and she knew things that American psychiatrists didn't, like that autistic kids grow up to become autistic young adults and then adults, or that autism, you know, came in many different flavors. So what she finally decided to do was, with a research assistant named Judith Gould in the late 70s, she did one of the first studies of autism prevalence in the general population. And what they saw in this London suburb called Camberwell was lots and lots of children with bits and pieces of this very narrowly drawn syndrome. So some kids couldn't talk at all. Other kids would, you know, play their favorite phonograph record for the 500,000th time before helping their mother put away the dinner dishes, etc. So what Lorna and Judith saw was the spectrum. But they had no way to make sense of their data until Lorna happened to come across a reference to Asperger's paper, which had not yet even been translated into English yet. She asked her husband, John, who spoke German, to translate it into English. She read it, and a light bulb went on over her head, and she said, "Oh, my God, this is exactly what I'm seeing here in London in the late 1970s. That's what Asperger saw in Vienna in the 1930s and 40s. And so she realized that Asperger had been right, that Connor had been wrong about, I mean, he was right about many things, but he was wrong about how narrow the syndrome was and how rare it was. So Lorna quietly worked with people like the subcommittee that was drawing up the chapter on autism for the DSM, the so-called Bible of Psychiatry, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. She basically quietly swapped in Asperger's broad spectrum for Connor's narrow monolithic syndrome. And very shortly after that, the number of diagnoses and the estimates of autism prevalence started spiking.
Hmm. So there was also no longer the need necessarily for children to be evaluated by one of the handful of people who specialized in this in the whole world.
That's exactly true. At the same time that the criteria were broadened, these diagnostic instruments, like one called the ADOS, the something like Autism Diagnostic Observation Schedule, was introduced, which meant that you didn't have to be Connor or a colleague of Connor's to diagnose autism. You could do it if you were trained in this method of administering this clinical instrument. The other thing that happened, which was huge, which I talk about for a whole chapter in my book, is that in 1988, one of the biggest things to ever happen in the history of autism happened, which was Dustin Hoffman portraying Raymond Babbitt in Rain Man. I must say, you know, I saw Rain Man. It was, you know, it made a big impression on me. I did not realize until I wrote this book how completely groundbreaking Rain Man was, in part because the notion that autistic people could be adults was still new when Rain Man came out. Lorna Wing was actually proposing it by changing the criteria so it could also apply to adults. So Rain Man was the first autistic adult that virtually anyone had ever seen, including even many clinicians. And so Rain Man turned a formerly obscure disorder into sort of the talk of the town. Like, everyone loved Rain Man. And in fact, one of the mothers of the one of the real life models for Rain Man, this guy, Joe Sullivan, and her mother was Ruth Christ Sullivan. She was sort of one of the Lorna Wings of America. She launched the autism parents movement in America. She told me that before Rain Man, she would constantly have to explain to her, like her neighbors or whatever, no, my son is not artistic. He's autistic. But then literally days after Rain Man, it was as if everyone had heard of autism. And she told me, quote, Rain Man did more for autism than we had been able to do for like 20 years.
Let's go to the phones at 800-933-5372. We have Trish on the line in Fort Worth. Hi, Trish.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Hi, Steve. This is Autistic Kids. How are you?
Oh, Trish. Hey, nice to hear your voice.
I'm so excited to be talking to you. Wanted to ask you a question. My husband is in medical school, and I am going back to school myself into the related fields. And I know there's kind of a disconnect between doctors, parents, diagnosticians in terms of the medical versus the social model of disability. And I was wondering, do you have any thoughts on how to bring the neurodiversity attitude into the field? I'm interested in becoming like a diagnostic counselor myself to help when parents get the news and have the panic freak out,
right,
and get them in touch with the autistic community as quickly as they're in touch with the medical community.
Well, you know, we're really on the cutting edge of society now. And one of the main reasons why I wrote this book was to write a document that would make understandable to even lay people who have no connection with autism whatsoever how the social conditions around autism have affected the way we look at it, even medically, for decades. And so really, my book, I think, is it's like a 500-page version of the social model of disability as applied to autism. And what the social model of disability says is that you can't just judge disability in isolation. You have to look at the ways that a disability is accommodated. Imagine if there were no curb cuts or wheelchair-accessible buildings. Then if you were a wheelchair user, you would be much more profoundly disabled than when buildings are made accessible and streets are made accessible. So it's the same thing with autism, although we're just figuring out what kinds of accommodations are appropriate for autism. But I sort of felt like one of the reasons why I wrote this book was that I felt like the idea of neurodiversity, which, by the way, the best short version of neurodiversity that I've heard recently was great minds don't necessarily think alike, in that there are various forms of sort of cognitive styles. We call it autism, we call it dyslexia, but these are all different ways of thinking. You could say they're different neurotribes, although I hate to overuse that word. But to introduce the concept of neurodiversity, I had to show that it was actually true in history. And it turns out that Asperger, the very first speech that he gave in 1938, was more or less a perfect plea for accommodations for neurodiversity. And he was obviously giving that speech under the most difficult possible conditions. But so I think this book, as it makes its way into the world and is read by clinicians and educators, will have an effect, because they'll see that neurodiversity is not just some fringe idea from blogs or something, although those blogs have been, you know, extremely important to the world in introducing those concepts, but that we really need to get behind the notion that instead of spending millions of dollars a year on obsessing over causes and cures for autism, we have to start autistic people and their families to live better, happier, more productive, healthier lives.
Time for one more call if we go quickly here. We have Michael on the line in Dallas. Hi, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
My question is today, and I love your show.
Thank you.
And my question is, first, I am autistic, and I was born in 1958, and I had so much trouble in school. I could not sit down. I could not concentrate. I couldn't do anything, and my parents just did not know what to do. Is it easier to be taught on a one-to-one basis rather than being integrated into a classroom?
That's an interesting question. Thanks so much for your call, Michael. Any thoughts, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing to do is to figure out which kind of classroom setting is most beneficial for a particular student. So in a sense, we have to customize education, which is being done with individualized education plans or IEPs, which every autism parent is familiar with. But we're just beginning to learn how, for instance, you know, it's better for autistic kids to be incorporated into mainstream classes when possible for a million reasons, one of which is it helps the mainstream kids get over their hang-ups about disability. Hmm. And bullying is one of the most serious problems that autistic people face still. And, you know, if we can destigmatize autism by familiarizing non-autistic kids with what autistic kids are like, they'll realize they're cool too in their own way. So, you know, I think we have to pay much attention to what each kid needs.
It's fascinating now, Steve, that a lot of autistic adults who are capable of living alone and living, you know, productive lives have sort of pushed back against the idea that there's anything wrong with them. They're different, but they're not necessarily in need of a cure.
That's true. But, you know, there's a kind of obsession in the autism community about the word cure, as if one exists. You know, it's like society has been working on a cure for schizophrenia for many years. There isn't one. You know, so the notion that should we use a cure or something, there is no such a thing as a cure for autism. It's, you know, as much a part of people as left-handedness or homosexuality or, you know, any number of complex genetic conditions. So it's not like, should we offer them a cure? There is no cure. What we should offer is what we know works, which is a society that makes room for different kinds of minds and for the challenges that autistic people face. I mean, the one thing that, you know, I've heard some people say, well, you know, shouldn't autism be considered just an advantage and not a disability? No, it's a disability. Anybody who either experiences autism themselves or knows autistic people knows that they're really struggling and their families are really struggling too. So it's definitely a disability, but that doesn't mean that we can't celebrate the beautiful aspects of having an autistic mind.
And in terms, just very quickly, of that apparent spike in cases in Silicon Valley in 2000, there's an explanation for that.
Well, the explanation that I wrote about in 2001 was called assortative mating, which is that, you know, basically computer people carrying the genes for autism were getting together because there were new social possibilities for them and, you know, would have autistic kids. However, I became, you know, sort of more interested in the larger social issues and challenges that autism poses for our society.
Steve Silberman has written for Wired, The New Yorker, the journal Nature, and the MIT Technology Review. His new book is called Neurotribes, The Legacy of Autism and the Future of Neurodiversity. Steve, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. I'm really honored.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Justin Martin today. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Braylon Becton. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.